Tune in Wednesdays for an afternoon of jazz. Hosts of Jazz Lives, A Jazz World, and Jazz in the Afternoon play the very best in jazz music. From the historical to the present, and jazz of all stripes. Swinging, smoking, bluesy, funky, new and old, but all good. That's Wednesday afternoons from noon to 4 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And welcome back to the live in the studio KBOO Political Perspectives here. Excuse me, getting myself garbled. My name is Paul Rowland. I was just on from 8 to 9 on Talk Radio, and here I am again. And we are talking with Yana from Lima, Peru. Are you there, Yana? Oh. Hello, Yana, you're with us.
Yes, I am with you.
Oh, great.
Nice to talk to you.
So maybe we'll have a little bit of delay from Lima there. And I'm sorry, I know your last name, but I just forgot it. Tell us your full name.
It's Yana Maximova, M-I-X-A-M-O-V-A.
Okay, and we will have a little bit of a delay, so I'll have to work with that. So tell us what's it like down there in Lima? Where are you at this particular moment?
This very particular moment, I am at the Hotel Bolivar in the historic downtown of Lima, which has some incredible buildings, some incredible history, and incredible ruins. And it's really hot outside, and as I was getting out of taxi, weather is, in high 20s Celsius. I need to do the translation on Fahrenheit, of course. But
I think that's in the low 80s, I believe, if I remember correctly, or I could be wrong.
It's just beginning of summer here in Lima.
Okay, that's right. It's on the other side of the equator. So at the Hotel Bolivar, is that where delegates and people attending the climate talks are staying?
No, my choice was Hotel Bolivar because it was really close to the march that I just came from. Today, December 10th, there was a big climate march organized by several different organizations. Not as big as the one I attended in New York City in this September. Still, a few thousands of people, different organizations. We marched from the park called Parque de la Exposición to and in around, and the hotel was the closest, the nearby place to get on Wi-Fi and. Talk to you.
Okay, so let's just set the stage. People, Amy Goodman has been talking about, she's been from Lima, Peru on Democracy Now! The last few days. This is the 20th round of climate talks by the United Nations called the Conference of Parties, the COP process. And it's must seem excruciating to people who are concerned about the dire state of our planet that these talks seem to be endless and don't really seem to be producing much concrete results. You've been attending these talks, I understand. Could you maybe just talk about like a few of the major issues that are on the table right now?
Yes, absolutely. And as you pointed out, this is the 20th conference of parties. And there's a lot of hope put on it because it's leading to Paris. The agreement that will be drafted here in Lima will be up for debate and decision next year in Paris. So taking account of the previous history of the talks of the significance, for example, we had a Copenhagen, and it was a complete failure. So people really do not want Paris to look like a Copenhagen. And if there is nothing, there's no good draft that the parties agree on at Lima, the Paris will be pointless to agree. In terms of issues, there are so many of them. And I guess the main thing to point out is we see issues, but we need to talk about who is slowing down the process.
Okay.
And there's actually really good, really interesting event that happens every day at the conference called the Fossil of the Day, governmental organization. And what they do is they give an award to the best in the work of the day, who got the first prize yesterday. Then we had Australia, we had Switzerland. You can see a lot. I mean, you can actually see the pattern of the very well-developed countries that are backing off from making actually some serious commitments. And that is, to me, has been a kind of the main thread throughout this talk. If you can see the developing countries, they're pushing and pushing the more developed countries to actually commit to reduce their greenhouse emissions. And it's really sad to observe, but in the same time, I totally understand that there is a lot of private industry interests are involved and interfering with the DAP, with what is decided upon.
So,
and I can talk about it if you want.
Yeah, the issue of corporate presence actually at the conference itself is that actually, are there actually lobbyists and corporate representatives like actually participating or in the hallways? What sense do you get of that?
Well, I'll tell you about the Shell oil, because we recently had a big protest, and actually Democracy Now! Crew was right at the protest, organizing Spider Cop against Shell oil participating in panels, participating in dialogue. And I personally attended the panel put together by IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and they invited representatives from the government, representatives from non-governmental organizations, representatives from industry, and as a representative for industry, the very, very handsome, very educated gentleman, his name is David Holmes, he's a chief researcher for Shell industry. So when it was his time to give a presentation, he stood up and he said, for all the people who think that oil should remain in ground, I have to say the following: this is unrealistic. So, and he said that there is no way we'll get off the oil economy. So the solution that he offered, actually an incredible one, is what Shell has been pushing. It's something called carbon capture and storage. It's a facility that is supposed to be actually capturing CO2 and storing it under the ground. So his main point was, let's not address the cause. Let's address, the side effects, the symptoms, and let's just go forward with building this fantastic creation like carbon capture and storage facilities.
Well, it seems like the approach, the technological approach, still seems to be sort of the dominant fallback rather than actually addressing the need to actually reduce consumption and restructure the way we're living our lives. It seems that there was a conference in New York a couple months ago about techno-utopianism, sort of this myth that technological solutions will save us. Was there other discussion, say, of geoengineering, which is kind of, I don't know if they even want to talk about that. Was there any discussion of geoengineering, or was it, all about this attempt to iron out some sort of a general framework of agreement for reducing carbon output?
There is a really interesting discussion happening here. I'm actually not familiar with what you are talking about, but there is a really big initiative sort of put out by United Nations. It's called RED Initiative, R-E-D-D Initiative. And
there's some background noise. It's kind of distracting. I'm not sure what that is.
Okay. Is it any better now?
Yeah.
Okay. It's good. Yeah, see, I was talking about the REDD initiative. And it's an initiative that is actually, will most certainly benefit the corporation, because it is an initiative to establish the carbon price, pricing carbon, and so to make it possible, in theory, for indigenous communities who live, who own the forest and live in the forest, sell so-called carbon credits to the major polluters. So, and if you can imagine, the polluters are the ones that are really pushing this initiative and pushing this toward actually, you know, yes, let's agree on something. And to me, it's a very, very ironic, because it's as if the big corporations are trying to buy more time to do their evil deeds, to suck up the whole old oil reserve dry to pollute as much as possible, and then maybe move on to something surreal, like, I don't know, selling up air, bottled air, something like that. So there are some conversations, but they are happening as if they're happening up in the clouds and not down on the ground. And so it's very so often the indigenous communities are taken out of the equation and are not represented. So you don't see the indigenous people sitting down and discussing those initiatives.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the, you know, protecting forest areas and indigenous peoples. I don't know if this directly relates, but I just was just reading that this current UN climate meeting is going to have the biggest carbon footprint of any UN climate meeting to date. More than 50,000 metric tons of carbon. The negotiator's burden on global warming from this 13-day talks. It's about 1.5 times the average for a UN meeting, which obviously is already fairly high. So these people are themselves contributing to global warming without necessarily making such a major impact. But it's partly because they had to build the facility for these negotiations, and the electricity is all from diesel generators. Now, the reason I mention all this is also because now they have this whole idea of mitigation, which I was talking about during the talk show on the liquefied natural gas facility. The mitigation, which is carbon capture and storage, is basically a mitigation. That's their fallback for any large project or any, you know, even larger, you know, issue like global warming, is that they're going to supposedly mitigate it through some sort of compensating mechanism, or like carbon capture and storage. Or in this case, they're supposedly going to offset the carbon footprint by protecting 1,500 square kilometers of forest, which is a very interesting thing. Now, like, where that forest is, how it's going to be protected. I mean, they're kind of asking us to trust them that this is going to be permanently protected forest, which is going to somehow offset, you know, in the long run. Anyway, that's just kind of pointing that out as the sort of contradictions that that is involved in this the climate meeting that we're all involved in. So let's unless you have some direct response to that, I was going to ask you about sort of more directly, you know, you mentioned that there's a climate march there. What's the police presence like there in Lima? Is it very visible? Does it seem kind of militarized?
Yeah. Well, I'll start by telling you actually just start at the venue where it's all happening, as you pointed out, that they had to actually build a facility. So it is happening in a territory military complex called, as known here as Pentagonito, the small Pentagon, which is, as my friend Alex, who actually writes for PR Watch, pointed out, it's very ironic that the UN chose to hold their talks inside the Pentagonito, the place with a very dark history, with history of torture, and also what it represents. You know, it's a small Pentagon. It represents this a war industrial complex. And as also, as my friend joked about it, he said, it would be actually really nice if UN all of a sudden said, all right, this time we're going to take it seriously, and this time it actually would be a war on ecological terrorism. That would be an appropriate, that, you know, in this way it would be appropriate to justify why we're holding this event at such a highly guarded military training facility. And as far as police presence, it's present. There is a lot of it. I personally, every time I see some of the National Guard, I feel very conflicted about it, because they look very much like an Indonesian paramilitary that's been involved in, you know, in so many massacres and disappearances and murders. They do look very much like maybe just the similarity of their uniforms. On the ground, I do feel like we've been very, very, very sheltered. It's like the contrast between what is on the inside of the venue and what is on the outside on the streets of Lima is incredible. It is incredible.
So do they prevent, yeah, does the police prevent regular citizens from getting near the conference? Is it very difficult to get access there?
It is very difficult. You always have to, I mean, I pretty much don't take off my badge as I, you know, I get up in the morning, I put on my badge, because in order for me to get on the special shuttle that delivers people from different locations in the city to the venue, you need to have either press pass or delegate pass, one of those. You cannot actually get on the inside of the regular citizen unless you are there for the first time trying to get your credentials. So, and I actually hear a lot of stories of large groups of indigenous people who traveled from the mountains to come to the venue thinking that they actually would have a place at the table. They walk in, they present themselves, they say, we are here to represent this tribe or that tribe. And of course, you know, the response we get is, oh, you're not in our computer, you're not in our database, and we can't let you in. So there are large groups of people that are turned away every single day. So that is a reality. And I guess the short answer to your question is not, no, you cannot get inside the venue.
So are there
pretty much anywhere nearby.
So are there clash? You know, you said that there's demonstrations. I mean, are there clashes with the police? Are there people being arrested? Or, you know, what's the climate like out on the streets? How close can people actually get to this Pentagonito?
Not very close, because like I pointed out, it's a very big military complex. It's very large. So it's also the place where you have the actual building, you have a venue, and you have a lot of land that is used by military for training. So there are trenches and there are exercise, whatever, machines or whatever you call them. It is, and it's the, of course, the building itself, you know, it's heavily guarded. I mean, it's a military building. It's been historically guarded.
That seems deeply emblematic, really, for the UN to be holding their conference in such a place. It seems the shape of things to come.
it's very true. So, what did I want to say? And I guess I wanted to point out that I certainly feel like being a white, like Caucasian, from the United States, it is, I mean, I certainly get a preferential treatment. And my friend, the person who hosted me for the first week of the COP, she is a native Peruvian, and she also an attendant of the conference. She is an observer with an indigenous Amazon Alliance. So I felt like, you know, we both have our badges, but I get the preferential treatment because I'm white, and because I speak English, and because, you know, I don't know, Paul, how to really explain it. It's just a feeling that is very prominent.
Well, it seems like another way that whole conference sort of represents the reality of power in the world today, and how people who are trying to, you know, influence, have a say at the table of power, continue to be shut out in so many different ways that you're painting that portrait. I think this is really valuable for people to get a direct sense. Obviously, you know, as I said, people should continue to listen to Democracy Now!, which we air on KBOO twice a day, because she's been covering this. But this is, you know, we're able to get a direct voice from in Lima, Peru. And again, we're talking with Yana, a KBOO reporter who is on the ground in Lima attending the COP, that's Conference of Parties, conference, the 20th round of climate talks sponsored by the United Nations. Going on for how much longer is this going on for, Yana?
It's going to end this Friday. So, you can actually feel the tension. Tension is building. And non-governmental organizations put a lot of pressure on. Well, they are putting pressure. At least they're raising awareness that the talks are, you know, the negotiations are just taking a long time and not yielding a positive result. So there is still some hope. Today is Wednesday. Talks going to end on Friday. Today and yesterday, we'll data when we received presidents, like the president of Bolivia, Evo Morales, spoke, addressed the plenary yesterday. Today we have the president of Mexico, Enrique Peña Nieto. We have Russian delegation. We have a representative of the United States. We have big players addressing plenary. I'm not here to actually listen to it, but I'm going to follow it. And I guess one thing I wanted to point out, there is a way to listen, to actually live stream and stream look at the archive of all the talks that are happening. And it will require a little tweaking on the internet, but generally, if you search for UNFCCC COP20 live stream, you will find the link. You'll find the website. You can watch all the talks, all the plenaries, negotiations. Unfortunately, not side events, but pretty much anything, even press conferences, which is actually incredible. For me, I actually never, in the past, I've never seen the press conference in live stream. So it is a good way to stay tuned, and of course, if you have extra time and if you're not afraid to die from boredom, it's something interesting to check out.
So Yana, you mentioned, you know, the tension is building. There's only 3 days left in this conference, and you said that unless some agreement is made now, leading into Paris next year, that the Paris talks, which are supposed, I guess, going to be the conclusive talks for wrapping up some sort of new global deal. So where are things at? I mean, what's the feeling of people? Do they think that they're, I mean, just from the point of view of even coming up with something that looks like it's going to go somewhere, that's not just going to completely fall flat, you know, not to say that that's anything anywhere near adequate or leading towards actually resolving, you know, the climate crisis, which they don't seem to be capable of doing from my point of view. But are people starting to get really worried that that nothing is actually going to come out of this?
Yes and no is the answer. And, of course, it also depends on the point of view. I mean, like, for example, non-governmental organizations, they're, of course, the ones that will always want more and more progress. And you know, less satisfied than many government organizations that are involved in bugs. So where we at, we are still in this really interesting phase of trying to connect dots of, like, we're talking about, do we need to prioritize mitigation or do we need to prioritize adaptation? How are we going to go about it? There's some, you know, in terms of adaptation and mitigation, like there's something that's called the Global Green Fund, and it's an initiative with Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. Many countries already pledged millions of dollars to the Green Fund initiative. But as from the point of view of adaptation and the people who are working on the issue, it is not enough. It is just simply not enough. But it's kind of a cycle. Unless we really start caring about and understanding that mitigation has to come first. In human language, it has to be stopped before it gets so worse that we don't have enough money to deal with the consequences. And, you know, money is not a, you know, it plays a big role, but it's not going to actually decide who lives or who dies.
Yeah,
so,
no, that's...
And there's not even a conversation about loss and damages to pay, like, the reparation. For example, the Philippines, who got hit last year, you know, last year around the time of Fox, Philippines had this, I mean, devastating tsunami. And the countries are like Philippines, for them, loss and damage is essential, is an essential, as you know, as well as adaptation. But, you know, worse it gets, you know, more money you will have to funnel into the reparation. So at this stage, I still feel like there is just, we're still talking what is a priority, which to me, like, maybe I'm just young and impatient, but I feel like the priority now is not talking, priority is now acting.
Yeah, well, that's the $20,000 question. So we only have a minute left, Jana. Any other strong impressions you want to leave our listeners with from your time there in Lima?
Yes, I would like to say that, you know, there have been a lot of things that I felt really sad about, but the real inspiration came from speaking to indigenous people. They are, you know, some conversations are heartbreaking. Some indigenous leaders, they tell me we are helpless in front of our government, but these people, they radiate this light and they radiate this warmth and compassion that is just, it's incredibly valuable. It's something that, you know, that helps me to just move forward.
And of course, no doubt in stark contrast from the cold bureaucratic face of many of the government and corporate and other people attending the...
Exactly. Yes, it's a very good description. And the last thing I would like to say, as we speak, outside the Hotel Bolivar, where I am now, there is a gathering of indigenous community. They're waving their incredibly beautiful, colorful flags, and they are they play music. They're very passionate. There's a very passionate conversation happening right
okay,
there,
Yana,
right now.
We gotta break in because we gotta run. But we've been speaking with Yana Maximova. Thank you so much, Yana, on the line live from Lima, Peru, at the UN Climate Talks. Thanks.
Thank you, Paul.
Okay, and we got to wrap up this special presentation of Political Perspectives here on KBO Community Radio. My name is Paul Rowan. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Air Cascadia.
Morning, Cascadia. Today is Wednesday, December 10th, 2014, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. Today's guest, we're going to try to get Cordelia Finley with Forest Defence, Cascade Forest Defence, back to report on the outcome of yesterday's event, as it were, in Salem,